Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. And I'm sure today's 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination is landing differently in the lives of people who were alive and aware of it at the time and those who weren't. Maybe for some who weren't alive or weren't aware yet, you're tolerating just another example of media anniversary hype. But for those of you who remember, this is emotional and personal, not just historical. So let's take calls on this 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, first from people who remember President Kennedy and later from people who don't. And yes, let's begin with some oral history from people who do remember when the president was shot. This was the ultimate "where were you when you heard" moment. Maybe this and 9/11, the biggest two in the last 50 years, certainly the Martin Luther King assassination also, but even that not rivaling JFK or 9/11. So if you do remember, where were you when you heard President Kennedy had been assassinated? And beyond the grief and horror of the murder, how do you think the assassination changed you or the country? 212-433-WNYC. We will hear an incredible public radio moment from Boston that I mentioned before in a few minutes. Live on the air. I never heard this until this morning, but it's unbelievable what was happening on WGBH for part of that day. We will have civil rights historian Peniel Joseph and veteran TV newsman Marvin Kalb as our guests with your calls. And joining us now is Peniel Joseph, director of the Center for Race and Democracy at Tufts University, author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. He also has a piece on The Root today titled JFK's 1963 Race Speech Made Him an African-American Icon. And we're going to hear a little bit of that as our representation of Kennedy's own voice in this segment. Dr. Joseph, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Your article says the assassination had a profound impact on American race relations. Do you mean the assassination itself, in addition to Kennedy's record during his life?
Well, I think really both, because when we think about the assassination, it throws the United States into a national crisis. And it's really that crisis that Lyndon Johnson is then going to use, and so will Martin Luther King Jr., to push for civil rights legislation, really as an honorific, as to honor the memory and the legacy of John F. Kennedy. So within the 1 year after Kennedy is assassinated, we see all kinds of civil rights demonstrations, but we see the passage of the Civil Rights Act. We see Lyndon Johnson really come into his own as a legitimate president. And really less than a year after the Kennedy assassination, Johnson is elected president in his own right in a landslide. He gets 44 out of 50 states. So what's interesting is that Kennedy's assassination throws the country into a crisis, but it also is a time for renewal, and people are going to push for social justice in Kennedy's name and in Kennedy's honor.
The Kennedy speech that you write made him an African-American icon was a nationally televised speech about race delivered on June 11th, 1963. So that was a few months before he died. It was also 2 months before the I Have a Dream speech, which was August of that year. So we're going to play a clip from this speech and set this up for us. Why a presidential address on race in June 1963, and what was he trying to accomplish?
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
We'll start that clip in a second. Dr. Joseph, set this up for us. Why? Why did he this at this time?
Yeah, this year, 1963, is when Kennedy comes to find his voice on civil rights. It's also the year of Birmingham, fire hoses and German shepherds attacking peaceful demonstrators in Birmingham, Alabama. King writes his letter from a Birmingham jail. And it's also the year of George Wallace's famous stand at the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama, threatening to prevent the integration of the University of Alabama. So there's all these racial crises that are happening all across the country. There are hundreds of demonstrations. Thousands of people are arrested. So Kennedy feels that he has to get out in front of this problem and really show leadership. So initially he's going to do the address to sort of see whether there's violence when the University of Alabama is integrated that day. There is no violence. And he really surprises his advisors by saying he's still going to go ahead with the address.
So here on the 50th anniversary of his death is 2 minutes and 30 seconds of President John F. Kennedy in primetime on television, June 11th, 1963.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This afternoon, following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of two clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happened to have been born Negro. That they were admitted peacefully on the campus is due in good measure to the conduct of the students of the University of Alabama who met their responsibilities in a constructive way. I hope that every American, regardless of where he lives, will stop and examine his conscience about this and other related incidents. This nation was founded by men of many nations and backgrounds. It was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened. Today we are committed to a worldwide struggle to promote and protect the rights of all who wish to be free. And when Americans are sent to Vietnam or West Berlin, we do not ask for whites only. It ought to be possible, therefore, for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops. It ought to be possible for American consumers of any color to receive equal service in places of public accommodation, such as hotels and restaurants and theaters and retail stores, without being forced to resort to demonstrations in the street. And it ought to be possible for American citizens of any color to register and to vote in a free election without interference or fear of reprisal. It ought to be possible, in short, for every American to enjoy the privileges of being American without regard to his race or his color. In short, every American ought to have the right to be treated as he would wish to be treated, as one would wish his children to be treated. But this is not the case.
So for those of you who have never heard or don't remember hearing anything out of John F. Kennedy's mouth other than ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, 2.5 minutes of President Kennedy from his nationally televised address on race, June 11th, 1963, as we talk with historian Peniel Joseph. Peniel, interesting that he already hooked it to serving in Vietnam in 1963 as earning people equal rights. That was really early for Vietnam. And interesting that he was enforcing a federal court ruling. Today's Senate, before the nuclear option rules changed yesterday, probably wouldn't even have allowed him to get those judges on the bench. So how does history tell us that that landed in white homes and black homes who saw that speech?
Well, it was a tremendous speech. It's really Kennedy's finest moment as president. And before this moment, Kennedy had really been cautious. He had been hesitant. And
now, that's saying a lot. Kennedy's finest – is it his finest moment on race relations and civil rights? I mean, people talk about, you know, defusing the Cuban Missile Crisis and other things.
Well, I think it's finest moment on race relations and civil rights, but I also extend that really to his presidency, because I think that what he does in this speech, and it's the best speech an American president had ever given on race up until that point. Then LBJ is going to make some more remarkable speeches in 64 and 65. I think that he ties the struggle for civil rights and African-American equality to a larger image and vision of American democracy. And the reason he talks about Vietnam is because of the Cold War civil rights struggles that's going on in terms of the image of American democracy overseas. So he ties it to this sort of international, global, but also this domestic notion of democracy. In that speech, Brian, he talks about the life chances of black children versus white children. He talks about the opportunities that African Americans don't have just because of race. He says that basically now is the time to make real the promise of democracy, and really criticizes people who are saying that, he says, those who invite delay are really going to produce shame. And they're not being realistic. And the president of the United States is saying this. And he also says that there's a revolution happening all across the United States and that this revolution can either be peaceful or violent. So, I mean, it's truly a courageous and bold speech. And it's a speech that Kennedy makes because civil rights activists and ordinary citizens and grassroots activists, they force the president to do this. It's not just King. It's sharecroppers in Alabama. It's not just sharecroppers in Alabama. It's young students in Mississippi. And it's also white supporters and allies in places like New York City and all around the world who are doing sympathy demonstrations. So when we think about Kennedy, Kennedy is finally stepping up to the plate. But when he does so, when you read the whole text of that speech, you'll be blown away by how forceful that speech is and how critical of the nation that speech is. And he talks about we're in a country right now where we've been marveling over the film 12 Years a Slave. He talks about slavery in that speech. He says that it's 100 years after emancipation, yet the heirs of those who were enslaved are still not free. So to have a sitting American president, especially one with the iconography that JFK had even while he was living, is truly, truly remarkable. And it's been overwhelmed by the tide of history, including his assassination, the assassination of Medgar Evers the next morning, and also the March on Washington.
And yes, it was 100 years at that time since the Emancipation Proclamation, now 50 years since the assassination of President Kennedy. And listeners, where were you when you heard the news, if you were alive and aware? Norma in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Norma.
Yes, good evening. Good morning. I lived in Tehran, Iran at the time of Kennedy's death and funeral, married to an Iranian. My husband came home early in the morning. He had heard the news with all kinds of cakes and teas because he knew that the family would be coming to my home.
And Norma, could I ask you to, Norma, I'm going to come back to you in just a second. I want to ask you to turn your radio off, and everybody, when we take you on the air, turn your radio off so listeners aren't confused by the delay that's going on simultaneously. Kathy in West Islip, hi, where were you 50 years ago today?
Hi, I was walking home. I was 11 years old. I was walking home from Hillside Junior High School in Queens. We had been told that the president had been shot and had died, and they let us out early. And my arms were full of school books. I know I had one of those rubber straps around them. And I was just crying and sobbing as I walked home with my friend. I can very clearly see the moment when my friend turned to go into her house, and I had to walk on alone another three blocks to my home. And I remember thinking very clearly and consciously that I would never feel safe again. And I think that turned out to be true. It's as if a switch was thrown, and the kind of optimism that JFK had inspired in me just went out like a light. It was scary growing up in the 50s. You know, we had to hide under our desks because the bomb might go off in any minute. And I had great faith in JFK, and his vision of the world was an optimistic one. And I felt very strongly that good things would come of this. And
you were not optimistic politically in your life as much from the age of 11.
Yeah. No, I really think it's true. I've thought of that particular moment many, many times over the years.
Kathy, thank you so much for your call. Peniel Joseph, I don't exactly know your age, but I'm guessing you were not born yet when Kennedy was killed.
No, I wasn't born. I wasn't born when Kennedy was
killed. Now, you're a professional historian, so you're not typical. But how do you see the Kennedy legacy or mystique compared to people you know who were alive then, or any generational differences as a result of the trauma of the assassination itself. I think our caller there speaks for many people.
Yeah, I think there are generational differences. I think for those of us who weren't alive when Kennedy was assassinated, that the assassination really is extremely important, but it didn't hit us in the same way that it did for those people who were alive. But I would say that the Kennedy legacy has been so huge, and the myth and the legend of John F. Kennedy and the entire Kennedy family, but especially of the assassination and then the conspiracies around the assassination. By the time we came of age when Oliver Stone was producing films like JFK about the conspiracy around the assassination. And so the proliferation of Kennedy's iconography, if anything, it's grown more over the last 50 years. So in that sense, JFK is truly sort of American political royalty. So even though in the ensuing 50 years, and for those of us who came of age after Kennedy's assassination, we've learned all kinds of personal facts about the president, including scandal and infidelities, he still holds a very, very unique place in American history, primarily because people see his death as marking the end of one era and the beginning of another, even though that's too simplistic of a binary. But that's how many, many people sort of digested his assassination, that after his assassination, we get sort of more protest and more insurgency and civil unrest, and we get, you know, left-wing radicals, black power. We get more political assassinations of Malcolm X and King and his younger brother, Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy. So they look at the age of Kennedy, and obviously Jackie Kennedy bestowing that title Camelot on the entire administration posthumously has been extraordinarily effective in creating an aura, and an aura of legend and myth around Kennedy. So I think young people really feel a connection with Kennedy that would otherwise not be there just because of the way in which that iconography remains. Whether you're a Republican president or a Democratic president, people try to channel JFK because he's American political royalty in that way.
Peniel Joseph, director of the Center for Race and Democracy at Tufts University, author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, and he has a piece on The Root today titled JFK's 1963 Race Speech Made Him an African-American Icon. Peniel, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
And now back to your oral histories of November 22nd, 1963. And we'll go back to Norma in Manhattan, who was starting to tell us before that she was in Tehran, Iran, on the day. Norma, you want to start over?
Certainly. Thank you. I'm an American and was married to an Iranian at that time. And I remember clearly my husband coming home very early with his hands full of cakes and desserts for guests, because he knew that when the family heard the news, they would be coming to give their personal condolences to me, and they did. And they arrived within a few hours bringing lilies, because one of our brother-in-law's graduate of the University of Texas told everyone that lilies are the proper flower of choice at American funerals. And the family were genuinely upset by the death. They were hugging me very closely, trying to outcry the other. And the mothers were saying, those poor children, so young to have lost their father. And they asked each other, who would do such a thing? And then, don't be naive. Of course, it was Johnson, answered the senator in the family, wise in the ways of millenniums of assassination.
Oh, that was Oliver Stone was with you in the room then.
That must have been.
Do you think the same thing?
And then the day of the funeral, there were masses at every church and prayers at the synagogues and the mosques. The American embassy held a reception for representatives from all over, from foreign embassies, the Iranian dignitaries. And the military arrived in respectful full dress. And the embassy announced that a condolence book would remain for a week in the main hall of the embassy to be sent to the president's widow. And all that week, for hours, lines of Iranians waited patiently outside in cold November for a chance to write their personal sympathy to Jackie Khanum Teflaki.
Do you think if God forbid President Obama were to be shot today, that the same thing would happen in Tehran?
I absolutely do. I'm in Iran. I send cultural trips to Iran, and the Iranians, besides, in spite of the sanctions, love Americans, and I sincerely believe that there would be acknowledgement of the death in a very respectful manner.
Norma, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. Here, folks, is an incredible Where Were You moment that was broadcast live on WGBH Public Radio in Boston. On that afternoon, November 22nd, 1963, they were broadcasting a live Boston Philharmonic concert that was supposed to begin with an operatic suite from Rimsky-Korsakov, but the conductor, Eric Leinsdorf, came out for the moment that the audience members would never forget.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the wires. We hope that it is unconfirmed, but we have to doubt it, that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination. We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
And as the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony plays in the background from November 22nd, 1963, where were you when you heard the news, if you were alive and aware at that time? Was anyone listening now in that Boston Symphony audience? Were you one of those gasping people? Did you even stay for the music? You couldn't go into the lobby and start tweeting or texting in those days, right? Or were you listening to WGBH at that moment? Or where were you when you heard the news, whether in this country or another world capital like our last caller, or perhaps immigrants elsewhere in the world before you came here? Where were you? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Mason on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mason.
Hi, I'm actually calling. I live in Staten Island, but I work here in Martin, here in Manhattan. And I guess my story is that I remember exactly where I was 50 years ago today. I was in my third grade classroom, and I remember the principal, Mr. Wise, getting on the PA system to announce, unfortunately, the president had been shot and had died. And everybody in the class kind of looked at each other, huh? President of the United States? Can't be. And my third grade teacher was crying. But then I also was told that, you know, my father would be coming by to pick my sister, and who was in kindergarten at the time, up. And it was only then when my father said, yes, the president has been shot, and on the way home hearing about it.
How do you think it affected you?
Well, I guess it came to a surreal world in the sense that a few days later, we saw Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald, and we were wondering what was going on.
Mason, thank you very much. Doris in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi, Doris.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was in the hairdressers. It was Friday. But an interesting thing happened. My son came home from college, and he told me that he had always been surprised when I told him how we cried when Roosevelt died, and he thought, isn't that strange? Who would ever cry for a president? And then he came home from school and said that besides his weeping and wailing, everybody on campus was hugging each other and hugging trees and hugging poles and just finding things to hug. They were so beside themselves. And he said, and now I know how you can cry when a president is shot.
Doris, that's an incredible story. Do you think it affected his optimism about the future, like we heard from an earlier call?
I couldn't tell you because, unfortunately, my son has passed.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So, but it was my daughter was 10 at the time. She came home from school. Everybody came home, and we were glued to the radio.
Doris, thank you very much. John in Long Beach, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, Brian. I was 4 years old when I was standing in front of the television. I remember that day. And I remember it as my first television moment, really. That and watching Oswald get shot. And it's interesting because I don't think I was aware of how much it affected me until recently. You start questioning and looking, and you know, after Oliver Stone's movie came out, and all of the questions that remain surrounded in mystery. That sort of intrigues me, and I also think it set the bar, like the earlier caller, the gentleman mentioned about the presidents, you know, all seem to want to aspire to be JFK-like. It just seems that he set the bar for what a great president would be look like, I think, in this country.
John, thank you very much. And thanks for the calls from those of you who remember November 22nd, 1963. We want to fold in calls coming up from people who are too young to have memories of that day. What do you think of the Kennedy legacy if you weren't alive for the glamour of the Kennedy mystique or the horror of his murder? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As we clear the board for these calls, what did your parents tell you about JFK or the assassination? How much of that affected your own take of the world? And immigrants, again, please join in. I would love some of you immigrants from anywhere to call in and tell us, how did you learn about Kennedy when you came to this country? Or what did you hear about him in your home country, if anything, before you came? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And if John, our last caller, said that that's his first TV memory, we will talk next to veteran TV journalist Marvin Kalb, who was working that day. Stay with us, your calls, and Marvin Kalb after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on November 22nd, 2013, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Thanks again from the calls we've been taking for the last segment of the show from those of you who remember November 22nd, 1963. Our phones are open for people who are too young to have memories of that day. What did your parents tell you about JFK or the assassination? How much of that affected your own take on the world? And how do you think you view the Kennedy legacy differently from people who were alive during that time? We heard that incredible moment from the Boston Symphony Orchestra and audience broadcast live on WGBH at that time. We also are told that according to the Daily News from the next day, November 23rd, WNYC carried, quote, a solemn concert conducted by Leopold Stokowski on the day of the assassination. So how they scrambled that so quickly and aired it, I don't know. But apparently that also happened, but in reaction to the assassination, not having already been planned and then changing direction with the conductor announcing the shock to the audience. So some WGBH, WNYC history there. We welcome now veteran network newsman and in recent years scholar of journalism, Marvin Kalb, who was fittingly teaching media studies at the John F. Kennedy Center at Harvard for many years, now senior advisor to the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, host of the Kalb Report on PBS stations, and author this year of The Road to War, Presidential Commitments, Honored and Betrayed. Marvin, thanks very much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much, Brian. Good to be back.
So people who are alive and watching CBS probably most remember Walter Cronkite anchoring and Dan Rather reporting from Dallas. Where were you on that day?
On the day that the Kennedy was shot and killed, I was at the State Department listening to a briefing by the Assistant Secretary of State, W. Averill Harriman. He had just come back from a trip to Vietnam, and he wanted to persuade all reporters that everything was going brilliantly there. And it was worth a 45-second spot. I listened to Harriman, sort of wrote the spot in my mind, walked to the small CBS studio that existed no longer at the State Department, overlooking the auditorium that Kennedy used to do all of his news conferences. And I picked up the receiver and talked to the editor. And in the background, I heard Alan Jackson's voice. Alan was one of the principal CBS radio anchors at the time. And he said that Kennedy had been shot, that there were three shots. And something inside me said, knowing nothing, they must have hit Kennedy and he's dead. And that thought seized me. And I realized that professionally, I would probably not be that good on the air if I had to go on air immediately. And what I did was something totally unprofessional. I picked myself up and left the State Department and walked around the block. It's a big block. It took about 5 to 10 minutes. And when I got back to the department, I had composed myself. I was then able to think straight and to absorb information and to be able to impart it. But I knew that I could not do it immediately.
When did you first go on the air, and in what context?
I went on the air because our bureau chief, Bill Small, when I finally did get back and called in, he used a couple of unkind expletives to say, where have I been? And I told him that the information that was coming out at that time had no information that concerned a foreign connection. There was no information immediately that concerned a conspiracy or a possible conspiracy. That came within about 2 hours when they picked up Lee Harvey Oswald. Then, if you called a number of key people at the State Department who knew about Oswald's stay for 2.5 years in the Soviet Union, and then his pro-Castro sympathies expressed in many public demonstrations, you immediately had a line of thought. Wait a minute, what is going on here? Do the Russians have anything to do with this? The Cubans? What's happening? And then there followed, on my part anyway, a series of many, many calls to people I knew at the White House, at the State Department, up on Capitol Hill, getting to intelligence people. And what they were telling me was what was being put out, in fact, by the White House concerning Lee Harvey Oswald and the Russian connection, but with the quick afterthought that there was no evidence linking the Russians to the attempt on the president's life.
Marvin, here with me, some of our callers, some amazing stories I think we're going to hear from immigrants to this country who were not here or not yet born at that time. And we're going to start with Melanie in Livingston. Melanie, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks so much for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to briefly share my mother's story. My mother came from Cuba the month before that the president was assassinated. And she shared with me that she was in school when it happened, and she heard the news, and she went home crying and immediately ran to her mom and said, oh, my gosh, are we going to have to run again? Because she thought that because Kennedy had died, a communist regime would come in, just as had happened in Cuba. And
wow.
Just as it happened in Cuba, they would have to run to another country all over again.
And did she develop or ever talk to you about any theories about why Oswald did it, knowing the Cuban connection that Marvin Kalb just referred to?
She didn't, actually. She always thought that he was just a disgruntled person, and she never really... I think even as an adult, she's passed away, but even as an adult, she never really thought about why it happened. It was more the impact it had on her and how horrific that was. I think it really changed her childhood to have that experience, so I don't think she ever considered it beyond that, how it affected her.
Melanie, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Gabe in Brookville. Gabe, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, hi. I came from a communist Hungary, and I clearly remember that I was 10 years old at that day, and after school activities, I participated, and the teacher came in and told us that the president of the United States was shocked. And I remember the shock went through us, and he was very, very left a deep scar in me, I guess. And I just want to mention one thing. It was, the United States was considered as a staunch enemy of our state and our way of life. But despite that, lots of people, we were talking about all the kids and our parents when we went home. And... despite that was, outburst of sympathy personally for the president. And many years later, when I came to the United States, one of the first things I did, I came somehow, or I purchased Kennedy, I forgot his quarter, a silver quarter, or half a dollar.
Half a dollar, yes.
And I still have that in my prized possession. Since this day, and that was like 35 years ago when I moved here.
Gabe, thank you so much for chiming in from Brookville. Gabe's experience being 10 years old in communist Hungary and remembering it, learning about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Loris in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Loris.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I was 12 years old at the time in Grenada on the island of Carriacou. And I remember I was coming, actually it was after school, and returning. I usually have to go to the garden, gather firewood and grass for my donkey. And as I was coming home, and I got right into the crossroads, and I met my cousin, whose name was Anthony, and he said, "Have you heard? They killed the president." And we were all very shocked, of course. I remember words like, they should skin these people alive who did it, things like that, to that end.
What did the United States signify to you at that time in your community in Grenada? A lot of Americans only heard of Grenada for the first time when Reagan sent troops in there later.
Yes, which was unfortunate. Grenadians generally love the United States, and even to this day, the ambition of any young person is if they could get to the United States in a land of opportunity, they would have it. At the time, I had a grandfather who was living here, and with a group of relatives, uncles and aunts, and with lots of other relatives in the United States. As a matter of fact, I came to the United States 1 year later. And with regard to Kennedy, I've never heard of the civil rights speech that he gave. So I always used to attribute most of the civil rights activity to Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, I see all this concrete work that he has done, but I really couldn't see anything that the president has done until just this morning. Hear this speech.
That clip we played earlier.
Right. Well, it finally just clicked, because it always used to amaze me, why are black folks so enamored with the Kennedy?
Yes, and Peniel Joseph, the civil rights historian who was on, said so many black Americans, especially after that speech, put amateur portraits that they were able to buy of JFK in their homes. around the country. So, Loris, thank you very, very much for your call. And we are also with Marvin Kalb, veteran TV newsman who was working as the CBS News State Department correspondent that day. The Kalb Report, by the way, will host a live show tonight at the main ballroom of the National Press Club with guest Dan Rather. We've got a link on our website for live streaming if you're interested. And Marvin, this was obviously before Twitter and Facebook, before cell phones or the internet. People find community there today in addition to in their face-to-face lives when huge world events happen, including traumatic ones. Did you see your job at CBS in any way other than to report the facts? People quickly knew the main fact, the president had been assassinated. Did you feel you had a community building or community service role beyond that? You talked about your own emotion. Did you communicate it or felt that part of your job was to tap in to help the public with their emotions?
I tell you, Brian, that one of the reasons I felt I had to take a walk before I went on the air was that I always felt then and feel today that journalists have a responsibility to keep themselves out of a story as much as possible, that their function in society is to be a kind of middleman between an event or a large personality and themselves. And at that particular time, I don't believe that the same spirit of community existed. I think that is something that we read from today back into what happened then. At that time, I don't think Walter Cronkite or rather any of us had in mind community. We had in mind doing the best job we could on a story of enormous importance in the U.S. and as we've been hearing around the world.
Even though people who were alive then remember television as kind of the national hearth on that day.
I think that what was happening as we look back upon it now, was something that was historic. For the first time, television was taken seriously as an instrument of news gathering and proliferation. And for 4 days, Kennedy shot on Friday, buried on Monday. And for that four-day period, with the exception, to the best of my knowledge, of a football game that CBS ran on Sunday, all of the networks, the three of them then, stayed on Kennedy, the assassination. And then on Sunday, there was the follow-up action, which was so extraordinary, that Jack Ruby shot the man who shot the president. And so we had a running story. And it was, first of all, everybody knew it was a huge story, but above and beyond that, we wanted to get all of these facts right because questions coming in at me were, okay, look, here's a guy who shot the president who spent years in Russia. We have to remember it was 1 year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which President Kennedy brilliantly maneuvered the world away from a possible nuclear exchange between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Was it possible that the Russians, in their humiliation, would seek to kill a president? Would they use someone sympathetic to Castro to carry out that act? Was the mafia in some way or another involved in this, working with people in Cuba? And so there were many of these questions, and of course, even to this day, we don't have specific answers to a lot of these things. We know what the Warren Commission reported, and we know what a lot of networks have done with that story, but we've never really carried it beyond the Warren Commission. And they said it was a single, deranged social misfit who shot the president.
What do you think?
What do I think? I don't think it's... I tell you, I've been asked that question so many times in this last week. I don't know, frankly, what I think. I think probably it was one man doing what he thought was right in his own perverted way. But we cannot ignore the fact that he operated in an environment which was heavily influenced by the Cold War, by a feeling of deep hostility and suspicion of Americans toward Russians, and I suspect Russians toward Americans. And the hostility bred insecurity. It bred feelings that you had to take action of some nutty sort. Immediately upon the assassination of Kennedy, I remember doing some research this week and coming up with phrases used by Pope Paul VI, for example, that the assassination proves that hatred and evil remain in the world, that James Reston, marvelous columnist for the New York Times, wrote in the Times the next morning, the worst of the nation has prevailed over the best. There's a strain of madness and violence here. We were thinking that the killing of the president had unleashed some dark, evil force in the land. And as you went through the 60s, you could, I think, with some justification, look back and say to yourself, by God, was it the Kennedy assassination that made it possible for the violence that then engulfed the nation in 1968 with the killing of Martin Luther King, of Robert Kennedy. It was a very, as you know, very tough time.
Abdullah in Queens.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. What happened 50 years ago, it was not only shocked America. I give you an example of the country where I came. Afghanistan back then was a very isolated country and undeveloped, and nobody even heard about the country's name. But I remember that I was about 7 or 6 years old, and my father was getting up early in the morning to do his prayer, and he was listening to BBC. And he heard the news, and he was very upset about it. And then he was calling some other his friends and relatives, and he was says, probably I'm the only person in Kabul that knew about this, because Kabul radio was not a 24-hour radio. It was starting at 7 o'clock, and the news was only in the evening. So when he called a few people, they knew already through the same BBC, and by that evening when he came, he said the whole office, everybody was talking about this assassination. And then I remember that for months, whenever there was people gathering, the conversation was about the John Kennedy's assassination. And back then, we were getting all our newspapers and magazines from Iran. Iran back then was a different country, was very close to the United States, and all the magazines were coming within a couple of days. They were coming to Afghanistan. We speak the same language, and people. I remember little boy, and when we saw that Caroline and John and the funeral sessions and Jackie Kennedy and her elegant, clothes. They were, yes. People were so fascinated.
Even in Kabul.
Even in Kabul, they were talking about it. They were looking about it, and the Iranian kept feeding that news to us. And we were, people were falling. I remember because back then even we had a king, but in our country, they keep everything very private. Even today, up to now, we haven't seen the face of Karzai's wife or his son's face. We haven't seen. They don't print those. Right. But when we saw a president playing with his children, or he is in his private moments, people were so fascinated. It was like to them for like a movie or a novel.
Abdullah, thank you so much. That's just great, great memory and storytelling on your part. Thank you very much. Lori in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. And you were too young, right?
I was. And I remember the shooting of Ronald Reagan. And I'm not sure what year that was.
1981.
Okay. So I was pretty young around that time, and my father, who was Irish and had a picture of Jesus Christ always hanging and really loved the Kennedys and he was a very quiet man, and I came home, and he put on the television, and we watched in the living room the news coverage of the Reagan shooting. And I don't know, do you say it's an assassination if he wasn't killed?
It was an assassination attempt.
Okay. So the Reagan assassination attempt, and we didn't know if he was going to die or anything. And I remember I can still see him in this blue suit, like waving, and boom, you know. And my father talked about the Kennedy assassination and how, you know, the country was never the same. And I remember feeling that day really close to my father through that, and feeling like, you know, that there had been a change in his life, and I could see it when he talked about it, and it just really has always stayed with me. And I felt it, and my father died not too long after that. And then with 9/11, I remember sort of having those feelings come up again. So,
And you got the feeling of how your father felt about Kennedy through his talking to you after Reagan was shot.
Right. And the way he watched Reagan, I guess, was the way that the way I watched Reagan was kind of the way he watched Kennedy. And in some weird way, it brought us together. And in a way where he didn't talk a lot. But, you know, he was an Irish, you know, his parents were Irish immigrants, not he. But I don't know. It was a sort of union. And I'll never forget that day with Reagan and my father. And few times when we were really, you know, that felt that close.
Yes. Lori, thank you so much for that memory. Marvin Kalb, still with us, who is with CBS News on the day. He's going to be doing an event with Dan Rather tonight, streaming on the Kalb channel, the Kalb Report online. We have a link on our site. And Marvin, before you go, here is a 38-second clip of Dan Rather on November 22nd, 1963. He was showing the viewers new footage coming in.
These are some of the witnesses in the area of the shooting. There was a great deal of disbelief at first that the president had even been shot, and even more disbelief that he was dead. Hospital sources gave this report of the arrival at the emergency entrance to the hospital, and I quote from the hospital, "The president was lying motionless in the car. Mrs. Kennedy was leaning over him, holding him. Governor Connally was leaning back in the seat, holding his stomach. Both men were covered with blood. Mrs. Kennedy reportedly held up very well inside. She was heard only to say, Jack, Jack, no, no."
Dan Rather reporting from Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. Marvin, I see that you already did an event, at least one event, with Dan Rather. If you were to tell our listeners, you know, as a journalist, of course, the highlight of that event, what did you and Dan talk about?
I think one of the things was the enormity of the story and how you have to be as loyal as possible to reality, to what it is that you actually know, as opposed to what you think or what you speculate. The public had to have confidence that what we were telling them was the truth as best we could find it. And I think both of us did the best we could in that respect.
Marvin Kalb, senior advisor to the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, author this year of The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed, and host of The Kalb Report. How can people hear that with you and Dan Rather tonight?
I think the best thing, really, I'm told that it's going to be streamed out of the National Press Club website as well as the George Washington University website.
Okay, and we have a link on our page for people who will find it the most easily that way at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Marvin, thanks very much for giving us time today.
Very welcome, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll keep taking your calls. We have so many people hanging on to speak who were mostly too young to remember the Kennedy assassination but have a lot to say, and also more of you who are immigrants to this country who remember the day or being told about the day in your country of origin. Stay with us if you're holding on. We'll take more of your calls in a minute. We'll be right back. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now back to more of your calls. Margaret in Hackensack, you're on WNYC. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thank you for taking me my call. In 1963, I was a 20-year-old Catholic nun living in a convent. And between the years 1961 and 1965, as part of our training, we did not have access to TV, radio, newspaper, or film. And I was walking across the college campus that day, and the bells began to toll, and no one knew what was happening, and there was a tremendous silence that just came over the land. And we all went back to the convent, and there was a small TV, and we put it on, and we sat practically for 4 days just watching it, astounded by what was happening. And it was just such a moment of the world impinging on solitude that I will never forget it.
Thank you, Margaret. Ron in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I actually didn't tell your screener this, but I've been thinking about it during the whole conversation. My father was a conservative rabbi, and he moved to Austin, Texas in 1964. And a lot of people thought he was crazy to move to Texas because of the violence there. He actually ended up becoming known briefly as LBJ's rabbi, and they had the second anniversary of the assassination in Austin where he was asked to participate. It definitely left a lingering kind of presence within my family. But I have to say, as somebody born after those events, to a certain degree, I find there's a kind of an indulgence among baby boomers in feeling that the world changed that day or the world grew up that day. To a large degree, every generation grows up on their own timetable. And the trauma might be 9/11. The trauma might be the World War II Depression era. The trauma could be the Civil War. But I think in many ways, those of us who are born after the events certainly respect that that was a transformative moment for the people who lived then. But I'm not sure I buy that the world changed that day. I think the world was filled with violence before and danger, and the world continues to be. And for those of us, all of us who've been watching over the last 12 and a half years, recovery after 9/11, I don't think that we can pretend that the assassination, as horrific as it was, as singular as it was, is different in kind or scope of other kinds of violence that we've seen together as a nation around our TV screens.
Ron, thank you very much. Gregory in West New York, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gregory.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was only 7 months old in 1963 in Peru. My mom was an American working at the Peruvian American Cultural Institute. And years later, I asked her about that day and how it had gone in Peru. And one of the things that shocked me was that she said that a few, not many, but a few folks were celebrating the news of the assassination of President Kennedy. And we talked a little bit more about it. And she said that some of the folks working there that were related to the embassy were staunch anti-communists. And they thought, you know, they had celebrated some, and that kind of always stayed in my mind, and it shocked me a little.
Were staunch? I'm not sure I understand. Some of them were staunch anti-communists, and they celebrated the death of President Kennedy?
That is correct. That is correct. They considered him to be soft on communism. So a few of them, not the majority. Most people were shocked and sad at the Cultural Institute, American. But some of them indicated that they were, you know, not sad about it.
Interesting. Thank you for that story. And strange in a way, because Kennedy certainly did not have the reputation in his lifetime of being soft on communism as president of the United States. We'll keep taking your calls for our last few minutes. Immigrants from anywhere, on how you heard if you were alive or how you were told if you were born later about the assassination of President Kennedy and what it seemed like in your country of origin, as we just heard from the previous caller, or anybody from this country who was too young or not born yet at that time, and how your parents talked to you about the JFK assassination and how it has affected you, if at all, growing up in the wake of it years later. We heard Ron and Greenwich say that baby boomers make too much of it, that every generation has its seminal violence that defines how they think about the world. Bindra in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Bindra.
Yes, I was at the base of Mount Everest where you have all these American climbers preparing to climb Mount Everest, and my dad had a curry shop, you know, to give them the energy to climb. And then Voice of America came on, and they said Kennedy has been assassinated. And that was such a turning point. I was only seven by at that age. And then when I came here, I learned the significance of this man, you know, with all these wars that we keep on going to. He's a household name in every corner, larger-than-life figure, iconic president, back of steel, unlike Obama and the rest, who are really politicians. But this guy was a politician, and he cared for humanity around him. So that's the greatness of this man. And coincidentally, you know, I learned that we went to war with Vietnam just 6 months after his death, just as we went to war in the Gulf 6 months after 9/11. It's such a coincidence, and history always repeats itself.
Yes. Well, actually, he deployed Americans to Vietnam. In the clip that we played earlier of his speech on civil rights from June of 1963, he already couched the argument for equality partly in terms of we don't discriminate on the basis of color when we send Americans to Vietnam. So already Kennedy was doing it and talking about it before he died. Thank you for your call, Benja. Val in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Val.
Hello. Hi, Dubai. I was 10 years old, and I distinctly remember having arrived from school, primary school at that time, and I was in the backyard picking some oranges when my father announced to all of us, there were about 10 children, and he said Kennedy had died. And it didn't occur to me, and then he who Kennedy was, and then he said the President of the United States died.
You were in St. Vincent, right?
St. Vincent, which was then a British colony. And everything was, in fact, should I say, Anglo-British-oriented. But when he said the President of the United States, should I say that everybody started it focusing and homed into us. That's where my aunts lived. And at the same time, this abstraction of United States sort of hit home. He then turned the radio up because we were one of the few people in the village who had a radio. And a lot of the neighbors came over to listen to us. And it was like you had to turn the radio, the old Grundig, which and focus in on Voice of America, which we all listened to for the next 4 or 5 days. Should I say our home was no longer private, it was public, in that everybody came to listen to what was going on Voice of America.
And what was people's general take? Were they just gawking at this huge event in a faraway place, the United States? I realize it's not that far away, you're in the Caribbean. But yeah, as people experienced it, or was there emotion or any sense of loss or any sense of threat to St. Vincent, for that matter?
No, it was deep emotions. And first of all, you had on, say, Voice of America, there was a lot of solemn music. So that in itself homed in on the environment. But for us in the Caribbean, we were very much aware of the American intervention. And we had a calypso then by the Mighty Sparrow, which said Kennedy was the man for them, which everybody knew that the Cuban Missile Crisis, what it meant. Yet, as a little kid, all of that was somewhat abstract until Kennedy died. Until then, that people realized who Kennedy was, what he had done with respect to civil rights and things of the sort. And so the United States was no longer an abstraction away from our British-oriented world, but front and center in front of us. Mm.
Val, thank you so much. Jessica in Midtown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Brian. I was born on the day that Kennedy was assassinated.
Wow, there's a birthday.
Yeah, I can't hide my age from anybody.
happy 50th birthday, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Have people remarked on this to you your whole life? They look at your driver's license or something as they're taking down your birthday and they say, November 22nd, 1963.
Yes, yes. It's just one of those dates. And, you know, Stephen King came out with a book, 11-22-63, last year, and it's just one of those dates that lives in infamy.
Just like we know some kids who were born on 9-11.
Exactly. To make it worse, I come from Massachusetts and from a Catholic family who were big Kennedy supporters. My mother was home that day watching TV, obviously very pregnant, and my father was at work. And he came home early to find her literally in a ball on the floor. And he said, I think you're in labor. And she said, no, I'm just really upset about the president. And he said, well, I think maybe we should get you to the hospital anyway. And so he drove her to the hospital, and I was born about 40 minutes later. My mother remembers it as being one of the worst days of her life. And she always apologizes to me when she says that. But she said,
gosh,
it was just awful. She said, here I am. It should be one of the best days of my life. And everyone in the hospital is crying. The doctor was crying while he was delivering me. The nurses were crying. She said she felt robbed of a wonderful experience.
Wow, that's some story. Well, happy birthday, Jessica.
Thank you, Brian.
Mauricio in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me well?
Sure can.
Great. I grew up in Bolivia. I was born 10 years after, not in the exact date, but nearly 10 years after Kennedy was shot. But the reason why I'm calling in is I was always very intrigued by the fact that the airport in the capital of the country, La Paz, was called the JF Kennedy Airport until 1999, as were many streets in different cities in the country. In many ways, JFK, despite the conflictive relationship between a country like Bolivia and the U.S., represents the American dream to Bolivians in a very good way. So I think that legacy has remained. And on a personal note, I got so intrigued by his story that I followed his life and where he had been educated and so forth, and ended up earning a scholarship to Milton Academy, which is where Bob and Ted Kennedy went. Huh. And when I graduated, I got an Ambrose book with in Profiles in Courage, which was written by JFK. So it's had a very personal effect on my life.
Mauricio, thank you so, so much. And Martine in Manhattan, you're going to be our last caller. We have 30 seconds for you. Go.
Yes, hi. My connection to Kennedy is very personal. I was born in August of 63 in Togo in West Africa because my parents had been inspired by Kennedy and Sergeant Shriver to be part of the first medical team to go out for the Peace Corps. And they had their training in 62 and met both President Kennedy and Sergeant Shriver. And I was born in Togo because they went there and were inspired by Kennedy.
Martine, thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for your amazing calls, remembrances among those of you who were alive, and all the reflections among the rest of you on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.